This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 292 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight. In this episode, we bring you a conversation with Diana Cooper, the Senior Vice President of Policy and Strategy at Precision Hawk. I'm speaking with Diana Cooper. She's Senior Vice President of Policy and Strategy at Precision Hawk. Diana, welcome to the UAV Digest.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, I met you very, very briefly at the FAA UAS Symposium. That was in June at the Baltimore Convention Center. And you were on the lunch plenary session titled From Strangers to Partners, Finding Balance Between Safety and Innovation. And as I recall, you also moderated the Doing Business in the Drone Age session. It really seems like you live and breathe drones. Now, let me see if I have this right. So, and you can tell me if I get any of these wrong. You're president of the Small UAV Coalition. You serve on the advocacy committee of AUVSI. You're on the board of the Drone Alliance Europe, the advisory board of the Energy Drone Coalition, and a United Nations working group. Is that correct?
That is correct. I've actually just wrapped up my term, my final term as president of the Small UAV Coalition, but all of the rest is still happening. And I'm also the new and inaugural president of the Drone Operators Federation.
Yes, we want to talk about the Drone Operators Federation and focus on that. Now, Precision Hawk has joined the Alliance for Drone Innovation. And the Drone Operators Federation is under the Alliance, is that correct?
That's correct. It's a new initiative under the umbrella of ADI that's focused solely on advocating for the cause of small and medium-sized drone operators across the country.
So the members of the Alliance for Drone Innovation, they include not only drone manufacturers, but suppliers and I guess software developers as well, is that right?
That's correct. And then this new initiative actually brings together Precision Hawk as the newest member and all of the members of our Droners platform, which there are about 10,000 Part 107 pilots currently engaging on the platform and growing. And ADI has also just recently partnered with Node, which is the Network of Drone Enthusiasts, which is a grassroots advocacy movement that started a couple of years ago to engage on state and local bills and different things that operators are facing in terms of regulation or policy activity across the country. So bringing in Node and bringing in Droners, we're now the largest advocacy network with about 40,000 operators across the country. So we're super excited.
One of the things that I took away from the FAA symposium was and I knew this partly, but the degree to which industry is working together with, you know, the regulators and all the stakeholders, it kind of amazed me the degree to which all of the people who have a stake in this are collaborating, working together to try to get us where we all want to be. How does the Drone Operators Federation fit into that?
So the Drone Operators Federation is engaging with the FAA, DOT, as well as legislators on the Hill on regulatory policy and legislative initiatives. So for example, you know, ADI and the Drone Operators Federation will be participating in some of the task groups that were initiated under the Drone Advisory Committee, which our CEO is now the chairman of. So there are many ways like that. Also, you know, providing public comments anytime there's a proposed rule out. We'll be engaging our network and getting their feedback and really advocating and championing, you know, their interests through these mechanisms.
And as the inaugural president, well, that's quite a position. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Did you petition for that, or did they come after you?
You know, I think it was a meeting of the minds. You know, we've been working alongside ADI and various other associations for, you know, the last year since it's been around, and they've been a great champion, especially for, you know, enthusiasts that are starting to become Part 107 licensed individual operators. And that fits very much in line with what we're doing with our Droners platform and that subset of the community. So we found, you know, a mutual meeting of the minds there. And Jenny Rosenberg had asked if I'd be willing to step up as president of the new Drone Operators Federation. And I was very excited to accept that role.
And have you had your first meeting yet?
Yes, we did actually just earlier this week. And this will be breaking news. We've got our first top line initiative that we'll be working on behalf of the drone operators within the network. And we're actually going to be looking at making some changes to a statute in New York City that effectively restricts drone operations from flying anywhere within the city limits.
Hmm. Yeah, that's been a topic that we've talked about on the show many, many times, is the federal law regulations superseding state and local level restrictions. Are the legal parameters for saying who has authority, is that well established, or is that something that's still kind of yet to be developed?
Yeah, it's a great question, one that we've been dealing with, you know, over the last few years since drones started, you know, operating commercially and recreationally in the airspace. And while preemption is, you know, derived from the U.S. Constitution, so federal preemption has been around for a long time, and aviation has always been under the purview of the federal government for safety as well as economic reasons. There are some laws and some rights that state and local governments have within their jurisdiction. For example, they have a right to do zoning and determine where airports are going to be located for noise and other, you know, reasons in terms of urban planning purposes. They also have a right historically to, you know, define where takeoffs and landings can occur, which was part of identifying appropriate locations for airports. Now, you can imagine in the context of drones where, you know, I can take off of the palm of my hand with some of the smaller models available on the market today. Now, is the city going to regulate whether I can take off from my right hand or my left hand? Do they have to designate one of them an airport? You know, do they have the right to tell me that I can't fly off of the palm of my hand, you know, after dark because it might be too noisy for anyone in proximity to me? You know, you can imagine it becomes kind of ridiculous within today's technology and today's context. And so, you know, a lot of cities and states have not actually really tried to fully enforce takeoff and landing to restrict flight operations within cities. But New York City, unfortunately, is one that has a very aggressive and far-reaching avigation statute that dates back about 70 years. And it was put together way before drones have been operating. But unfortunately, you know, there have been some attempts at enforcement actions and some fines, you know, levied on operators within the city. And so we don't want to see that happening. We don't want to see New York City being left behind from all of the great applications and opportunities for people to, you know, hone their skills as enthusiasts or hobbyists, you know, in and around the city, and also to do great commercial and public sector operations as well. So that's the first, you know, area that we'll be targeting with the Drone Operators Federation this summer.
I'm curious, if you're successful in that, and of course we hope you are, does that set precedent for other jurisdictions, or would that change just affect New York City?
You know, legally, it would only affect in terms of changing the statute within New York City, which affects the city as well as the boroughs. So, you know, an area that's affected by 10 million plus, you know, residents and people coming in and out of the city. So, but it does set a standard for other cities on, you know, how they should handle their right to zoning and takeoff and landing restrictions and things like that in terms of this modern technology. So I think, you know, the way that we handle New York City could be a model for our other cities as well.
Sure, that makes sense. Now, I also understand that you were on the FAA UAS Identification and Tracking ARC. And of course, remote identification was one of the big themes, I think, at the symposium that cut across so many other other topics. How do you think that is going to play out? I mean, it sounds like with the NPRM pushed out to, what is it, September, I think?
September.
Yeah, so obviously there'll be the comment period after that, and then the length of time for the FAA to assess and evaluate the comments they receive, and then, you know, then we'll see what happens next. But it sounds like it's something that's maybe 12 months off. Does that seem like a realistic timeline?
You know, probably in terms of full implementation, once the rule is in place, it's probably going to be about 24 months. So that is quite a lengthy, you know, time frame for us to be dealing with, especially since, you know, we've been trying to work on remote identification ever since 2017, when we had the Aviation Rulemaking Committee stood up, and the security agencies were clear that in order for us to have expanded operations like flight over people or beyond line of sight or package delivery in the future, we need to actually solve for remote ID. So it's so crucial. And, you know, unfortunately, regulations are not a fast process in the United States or in most countries. So that's why we're excited that under the Drone Advisory Committee, we've just established a task group to work on early adoption of remote identification solutions ahead of final rulemaking. So because we know that's about 2 years out, what we're trying to do is find ways to incentivize operators and manufacturers to incorporate remote identification technology into their products and their operations today, because we know a lot of these technologies are already available right now. So let's start chipping away at the security concerns today as opposed to 2 years from now. And the FAA is willing to hear industry recommendations on how to drive early compliance and how to actually incentivize that compliance on the FAA side. And I believe, you know, we're going to be looking at recommendations like, you know, the ability to state that you have remote ID in order to support your waiver application under 107 to fly over people or to fly in areas that might be more sensitive. So I'm really excited about this task group, and we're going to be delivering the recommendations to the DAC at the October meeting coming up.
Fascinating. Now, you mentioned that the technologies are available now, and you used the plural technologies, which is kind of what I thought. Are there competing technologies? Are there different technologies? Is there a consensus? And is it an issue if there are multiple remote identification technologies employed in advance of the regulation?
No, I don't think it's a concern at all. In fact, we want to see a marketplace of different types of solutions. That's the ideal way to regulate, is to have performance-based standards and allow the market to determine what are the best solutions for different use cases. Yeah. So people are coalescing around two broad categories, you know, networked remote identification, which is linked to an internet connection. It's tends to be better for expanded operations where you might want to have additional data and historical data available. So if you want to fly beyond line of sight or in very sensitive places and you have a network connection available, that might be the preferred solution. There's also broadcast technologies that are already available today on the market, most notably Aeroscope, which DJI has already made commercially available in the United States. Those solutions are more favored from some operators, you know, in terms of providing a very limited data set through the broadcast identification mechanism so that there's no historical data being tracked or made available. You know, and it's also available if there's no network. So if you're flying in an area where you don't have network available, you need to have broadcasts. So, you know, from our perspective, they sort of do different but complementary things. And some operators, especially doing advanced commercial operations, will actually want to have both types of solutions. They'll want to have the network for all the additional features to support their critical applications, but they'll also want to have a backup broadcast in case they lose connectivity.
And can I assume that there's some threshold below which remote identification wouldn't be required? I'm thinking micro drones, things like that.
You know, that's been debated for a while. At the end of the day, the FAA is going to put out the proposal in the fall, and they're going to have to receive public comment and, you know, weigh the economic costs of compliance with other interests from the security agencies. It's difficult to say. You know, from my perspective, there should be a carve out for micro drones that aren't very sophisticated, that can't fly beyond line of sight. But we'll have to see where things land. There's a lot of players in the space that, you know, have interest in the deployment and implementation of this rule. And I don't think it's just going to be up to the FAA to determine who it applies to.
Okay, interesting. Now, of course, it was very clear to me during the symposium that the FAA folks are completely engaged in the issues, in the technology. I mean, they understand this to a level that I really hadn't appreciated before I attended the symposium. You know, this is not a bunch of government, you know, employees that just really aren't aware of what's going on in the space that they're trying to regulate. It's the exact opposite.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. I mean, we're very lucky. We have a very forward-leaning, but also tech-friendly and tech-savvy set of regulators within the FAA. And, you know, this isn't their first rodeo. They get a bad rap because they haven't put out the rule yet. You know, not everyone really understands that there are security agencies and DOT that also, you know, has to weigh in and agree on what that proposed rule is going to look like. So, you know, everything doesn't just wait for the FAA.
Yes.
There are other factors taking place. But that said, it doesn't mean that they're complacent or they're sitting around or they don't understand remote ID or they can't figure out how to write a rule. You know, they've been very, very engaged, you know, as of 2017 on this and are very savvy in terms of, you know, what the market offers and what might make sense for the United States.
Now, how does that compare with, say the U.S. Senate or the administration? You've testified, I think, on UAS policy. What do you find when you talk to the other Washington representatives?
You know, a lot of the representatives on the committees that regulate the FAA and DOT, so Senate Commerce and House Transportation and Infrastructure, especially within the Aviation Subcommittee and TNI, those members and their staffers are pretty knowledgeable. You know, a lot of us, including myself, have spent a lot of time over the last few years working on the FAA bill and doing a lot of education on things like remote identification, beyond line of sight, detect and avoid solutions, you know, security concerns and the whole gamut. So we do have quite a few champions, you know, on both sides of the aisle, which is great. Not every industry can say that. That said, Congress is pretty large. And at the end of the day, there are still quite a lot of members that, you know, outside of these committees that are still confused or perplexed by the technology, or perhaps their only engagement with drones is, you know, having a complaint from a constituent. And so, you know, there's still a lot more work to be done. And that's why, you know, I'm really excited to leverage Node and the Drone Operators Federation to actually engage with local representatives and, you know, have them hear stories of individual operators and how they're using this technology and all the benefits.
Now, Precision Hawk has a new special advisor, right? A former U.S. congressman.
We do, absolutely. Former Congressman Lo Biondo from New Jersey, he's just joined us as a consultant, as a special advisor, working with myself and with our CEO on regulatory and policy strategy and initiatives. And Congressman Lo Biondo was the chair of the House Aviation Subcommittee for quite a few years. He has been a great champion for U.S. integration and really got what drones were about way before a lot of other people in Congress did. Back in 2012, he had championed the FAA Modernization and Reform Act provisions, creating the test sites and, he identified the need for us to, make a safe space available for companies to actually test that technology. Because if you'll recall, back then we didn't, this was way before Part 107. There really was no way to leverage, R&D within the country. And we saw a lot of large companies actually starting to go abroad, do testing in places like Canada and Australia that were more permissive. So he really championed the establishment of the test sites, and then all the way through shepherding the FAA bill that we got passed last October with a very significant drone subtitle of about 40 pages of, direction to the FAA on how they should think about integrating drones and how they need to work with industry partners and get to expanded operations that are going to tremendously benefit the country.
Now, also at the symposium, I had my first opportunity to run across the Precision Hawk CEO, Michael Chazen. He gave one of the keynote talks in one of the days there, and a very animated guy. Is he always that animated? Is that did we get to see the real Michael?
He is absolutely that animated. He cannot hide who he is, and he loves being on a stage. And I think he presents very well, not just on behalf of Precision Hawk, but as a champion of the drone industry in general, especially the commercial side of the drone industry. He brings so much enthusiasm and energy. And I think that's one of the reasons why he was selected by the FAA to serve as chairman of the Drone Advisory Committee.
And does that enthusiasm, I'm sure it does, carry over to the employees at Precision Hawk? I mean, what does it feel like to work at Precision Hawk? Do you feel like you're on the cusp of something very special, or what's the mood?
Absolutely. So I've actually been with the company for over 3.5 years now. And before that, I was outside counsel for about a year. So I've been there since the earlier stages when we were maybe around 40 or 50 employees or so around our B round of financing. So I feel like I work for a totally different company today than back then, because we've just experienced so much growth. I think we're close to around 300 employees currently. So it's been very exciting. I mean, we've moved offices once. We're just about to move to another office because we've outgrown our space. We've done, 5 acquisitions last year. So Michael's big on industry consolidation, and that's been one of our core strategic things that we've been doing over the last couple of years since Michael joined, is really identifying the leaders within niche aspects of the space and different industry verticals that we had not entered previously, and merging with and acquiring those companies and bringing them on board. So that, we can benefit from having the Precision Hawk brand and name and infrastructure of our larger company, and also have their niche expertise and their products and, expertise within those specific verticals.
Sure. Well, it seems like not 2 or 3 episodes go by when we don't talk or have something to say about Precision Hawk. It's such an active company. And one of the things I always love to do when I'm looking at a company is go see if they have a web page with the leadership team. And when I look at the Precision Hawk leadership team, I see way, way more diversity than is normally the case, at least for an aviation-related company. I think when I looked, there were 13 individuals on that page representing the leadership team, and 6 of those 13 were women. I think that's that's wonderful. It's great. How did that happen?
Thank you. Yeah, we're actually super excited about that. This is really something that Michael's worked on. When he joined the company, he brought Lara Erda on board as CEO. So his number 2 was, a woman that he had worked with at Blackboard and had a working relationship with for a long time. And Lara recruited our head of HR, Erin, who's also a woman, and she's been instrumental in, recruiting and helping grow other women leaders within the company as well. So I'm very lucky. I mean, we have a great culture. It's very inclusive, and women are really at the helm. I think we're 6 out of 13 in the executive leadership. Now, maybe next year we'll be 8 out of 15.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, that's really commendable. And that's also a competitive advantage. A lot of people or a lot of companies don't always view diversity from that standpoint. They think of it as, you know, sort of a, you know, social requirement or, you know, other kind of requirement. But I always viewed it as a competitive advantage when you bring a lot of diversity to a leadership team.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, meeting with investors in our various rounds, they're very excited to see a lot of, you know, women at the helm within our company, new employees from a recruitment perspective. I've had the opportunity to interview, you know, quite a few of our new employees, you know, over the last couple of years. And, you know, a lot of them, the women that I interviewed just said, what a great place. You know, I've never had the opportunity to work in a company, especially in the tech space, where there are so many women on the leadership team. And that's, you know, that's really sent the right message in terms of recruitment and investment opportunities for our company.
Yes. Well, you're so immersed in all of this. I have this vision, Diana, that someday I'm going to hear this buzz outside and I'm going to look outside up in the sky.
And that'll be me flying?
Yes, I'll see you and you'll have a rotor in each hand and one taped to each shoe, and that's going to be you flying along. But
yeah, I might be riding in an urban air mobility vehicle and then flying my drones while I'm sitting in there in my own unmanned vehicle, but yes. Yeah, that sounds about right. You've got the right vision.
Yes, yes. Well, so just finally, before we go, what does Diana do that's not related to drones? What activity or hobby or interest? Is there something else, or are you consumed completely with this?
You know, I'm pretty consumed. I do love my work, so it often feels more like a hobby, actually, than real work. But I do have some interests outside of the drone space, so I see ways that they can be bridged together. I'm a huge fan of design and architecture. Mm. I love traveling, looking at interesting buildings, both historical and modern. I love looking at bridges and the way that they're constructed. Of course, drone technology, you know, is a great way to do all of these activities. And I'm a big fan of art and also paint for relaxation and for fun while I'm at home. Actually, my first paintings were of drones and of a G5 aircraft. I think they're somewhere on my Twitter account. You scroll back a few years.
That's brilliant. Wonderful. All right. Well, great. Diana, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us and our listeners. I know they're going to really appreciate and enjoy the conversation. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Thanks very much for having me, Max.
And of course, we'll have links in the show notes, precisionhawk.com. That one's pretty easy, but also some of the Alliance for Drone Innovation, some of the other organizations we mentioned. We'll have all those in the show notes so that you can get to those directly from there. So again, Diana, thank you.
Thank you.